My name is Ron. I'm an alcoholic. And as a result of the AA program and the help of a lot of people in AA groups such as this and other groups, I have been sober since St. Patrick's Day, 1981. Driving over to the courthouse in Maplewood and realizing what a nice day it was, beautiful sunshine, warm for a December 2nd, and I started to compare that with 8 years ago and what kind of a day that was or might have been. Frankly, I don't remember it, but I remember where I was, and it certainly is an entire world of difference between today and that day 8 years ago. I could imagine what I would be doing on a Friday night. I'd be downtown at Jimmy Haig's Saloon, where I normally spend Friday nights with my wife. I didn't drink alone. And with a couple of people that I see in here. Cool. I grew up in northeast Minneapolis, had a brother and a sister, and a father and a mother. Grew up in a Catholic family. My mother was a good Polish lady, and my father was a Swede. Went to Catholic schools, I guess all the way through high school. In grade school, I think I was a good boy, there's no question about it. Was an altar boy, had a paper out, did all the right things. My father died when I was 8 years old. In fact, I see a fellow in the room here that spoke 3 or 4 months ago, and I was surprised at the similarity of our early years. His father, he never knew. Mine died at 8. We ended up going to the seminary together for a couple of years, and ended up here together. So I don't remember much about my father. I have a few memories, good memories, things we did together from time to time, but I was 8 years old, fairly young when he died accidentally. He fell down our basement stairs late at night, and I don't really know what happened. A drinking problem with him has never been identified, so I haven't really, I haven't really cared to know whether or not he had a drinking problem. My mother didn't drink, except on occasion. There was some family history with alcohol. My mother's brother was an alcoholic, and in fact, from time to time lived on and off of Skid Row, and died from as a result of the disease. After grade school, being the good Catholic boy that I was, I went up to St. John's Seminary and spent a couple of years up there. I decided while I was up there that wasn't where I wanted to be, and finished up high school in Minneapolis at De La Salle. As I mentioned, I had a brother and a sister. I was the oldest of the three, and I think early on took on some responsibilities that I understand the oldest often takes on when there's no father in the home. One of my proud memories is I bought the first television that we had at home. And while I was still fairly young, I think 11 or 12 years old, They did have television back then. Worked at the paper out to do that in high school. Worked at various part-time jobs, helped pay tuition to get through school. Had average or better than average grades in high school. Made the honor roll, as I recall, and did everything right. I didn't drink or smoke or do any of the bad things that some of my children do today. After I graduated from De La Salle on the honor roll, I started the University of Minnesota in the engineering school, and after 2.5 quarters, I dropped out before they let me go. I think my grade point average on a 3-point scale was 0.0 something. I wasn't applying myself, apparently. Worked for about 1.5 years, and sometime, I guess before I dropped out of the U, I had my first drink. And I recall that it was at a New Year's Eve party, and they brought me home at about 11:45. So my first experience was I got drunk and passed out. I think I got sick also. I didn't drink much after that for a period of time. But I did start drinking at that point. And, you know, for the next many years, 10, 12, 15 years, I think I drank kind of normally. Didn't get drunk, didn't drink every day, that sort of thing. Around my high school years, college years, I think I developed several traits or needs or personality traits, I guess, that I still have today. One of them, and this goes back early to grade school, is that I always looked to belong to the right group, and it usually was a group that I didn't belong to and that I kept trying to get into, whether it was the athletes or whatever group it might have been, you know, through school, after school, when I was working. There was always a group out there somewhere that I thought looked good, looked right, that I wanted to belong to, and didn't fit in, or didn't think I fit in. I also wanted to be, and still do, from time to time, I want to be a hero. I want to ride in at the last moments and save the day. And I can remember that going back to when I was a little kid. I also wanted to leave my mark. I mean, when I died, I wanted people to know that I had been here, and I wanted that to happen some other way than through kids. We have 9 children, by the way. And I also developed the habit of kind of living on the edge. I don't know. I see some heads nodding. I think you know what I mean. But things can't be just right. They can't run smooth. They can't be comfortable, that sort of thing. I always find some way to get myself on the edge, you know, so that I'm looking for a moment of panic somewhere down the road. Anyway, going back, so I stayed out of school for about 1.5 years, drove a meat truck, saved some money, bought a car, and I went back to school. Spent about another year, I think it was a year at the university, got myself up over a C average, and then I transferred up to Morehead State and finished college up there. And I graduated with magna cum laude, so I did well again in school. Also played football up there. Thought I could be a hero playing football. And I was for a while. until someone got my leg. After that, went to work for the General Accounting Office. I was an accounting major. And that's a government organization that audits government agencies and private contractors that have government contracts. Worked at that for about 4 years, decided I didn't like it. In the meantime, I had gotten married and had three kids, three boys. So I decided to go to law school. And why or how I decided to go to law school, I'm not quite sure. As it turns out, it's good because and I do a lot of trial work, and I can get in there and save the day at the last minute. So you make a good final argument and save the day. So I can still fulfill that dream once in a while. Anyway, I started law school in 1967. Changed jobs so I didn't have to travel anymore. And my drinking habits, I think, started to change about that time. Prior to that, there hadn't been anything out of the ordinary, I think what you would call social type drinking. Once in a while, it didn't get out of hand. I never got in trouble because of it. But when I started law school, I know my habits started to change. I think they did because I was trying to get myself into a position so that when I started practicing law, I could drink the way lawyers drink. Or the way I thought they drank. And actually, quite a few of them did. I went to William Mitchell Law School, which is a night law school, for 4 years and worked full-time during the day. So my family life started to deteriorate a little bit at that time, too. But with the working full-time and going to school full-time and studying enough to get through law school, and that's all I did, was I studied enough to get through. I finished with a C average or a C something average. But I started drinking more and more during that period, and as often as not would get into school after having stopped for a few, or leave early to go have a few, or both. And that went on for probably 2.5 years of the law school. At the end of my junior year in law school, I succeeded in losing a job that I guess earlier than that I lost a job, got fired, and it wasn't my fault, I can assure you. Got a good job with Honeywell out in Hopkins in their legal department, and about 2 months later they laid off 2,500 people, including me. So I was without a job, and that was the spring of 1970. That same spring got divorced and went through bankruptcy. Had no prospect of any employment that would pay me anywhere near what I was making. And so I ended up doing odd jobs and collecting unemployment for that summer. At the end of summer, I got a job as a law clerk making about one-third of what I was making before I got laid off by Honeywell. But the one thing that did is it got me to the point where I could go into private practice, which I didn't think I wanted to do when I started law school. But it was fortunate because then I could associate with the lawyers who drank like lawyers are supposed to drink. And that's what I did. That fall or that winter of 1970, I got married. I'd been divorced for about 6 months, and that was plenty long. And I had met this wonderful woman that had... She was a widow with four little kids, so it was perfect. So we got married and started our life out in Richfield. And it was also nice because she used to like to drink with me. So we had a real family thing going there. I graduated from law school, and instead of studying for the bar exam, I would go to the library and meet a few of the guys, and then we would go and drink and talk about taking the bar exam. And thanks to that activity, I had to take it twice. The second time around, I studied, and we didn't have any trouble with it. That was in 1972 that I passed the bar exam. And that same summer, I gave what I thought was one of my finest closing arguments, and my ex-wife gave me the three boys. So now we had seven kids at home. And I had low-paying employment, but I was doing what I wanted to do. Shortly after that, I think about a year after that, we had another one. So that we had eight kids there. During that initial period after I passed the bar exam, I lost the job I had with the firm I had been working as a clerk for. I worked for about a year for them after I passed the bar exam, and they let me go and hired my wife. I started with another firm out in St. Louis Park, and after about 6 months, decided that they didn't like the kind of law that I practiced. They were basically a business firm, and I was doing criminal work and personal injury, so we parted ways, I guess, by mutual consent, and that was about 2 weeks before Christmas in 1973. At that point, I opened my own office in downtown Minneapolis, and actually things went pretty well. The next year I made more money than I had made ever before. And I also was able to drink more and set my own hours. So things look good. For those first about 5 years, I would guess, when I was practicing on my own, each year business improved, made more money, and started to do more and more the things that real lawyers did, and that's to meet in the bars and talk about the law and talk about cases and that sort of thing. And before too long, I was doing that every day. Didn't do it much at noon, but that started to develop at the same time. So we'd have lunch in the bar, and fortunately there was a bar right next to the office, on that same bar I mentioned earlier, Jimmy Higgs. So we'd have lunch there and have a few drinks there, go back up to the office, work for a couple hours, go back down and have a few before going home. On the days that my wife worked, we would both meet there and have a few. And I'd have to drag her out of there finally and get her home. Actually, she said that if I wanted to, I could introduce her and she'd tell my story. I'm sure she'll clear it up at home later. And I also did all of the other things that I thought lawyers were supposed to do. I went to the seminars and I went to the golf tournaments and the different events that they put on, the insurance claimsmen put on seminars frequently, and there was always lots of booze and lots of drinks and good times. And things were going okay. I felt good. The business was going good. And nothing seemed to be suffering. And we managed to spend a lot of time with the kids, too. We did a lot of camping in the summer and did a lot of things together. Maybe not real quality time, but we did spend a lot of time doing things with them. During that, during that period, I was also a den mother for the Cub Scouts. And I was the only male den mother out in our area there. And I graduated to Cub Master. I was also president of the PTA out in our area in Richfield. And it ran very efficiently that year. Meetings didn't take long. A lot of committees were assigned, and we were in and out of there real quick. Things really didn't go too bad. We were always short of money, it seemed, but we still could do the things that we wanted to do and had to do. The next five-year period, things got worse. And mainly they got worse because of my drinking. I was really in the group now. That group had accepted me, a bunch of drinking lawyers. And by that time, I drank every day and usually would drink at noon for varying periods of time, you know, an hour, 2 hours, go back to the office for a while, then go back down in the late afternoon, and usually got out of there by 6:30 or so, unless my wife was there, then we'd stay longer. It wasn't her fault either. Other things started to happen. I started doing business out of the bar, which is not a good practice. I started writing a lot of bad checks, and I used to have a series of liquor stores and bars where I could write checks, and I could cover them. I could make sure that none of them would clear before another one hit to cover the one I wrote. So I could keep that going for quite a while, and all the people that that got the bounce check knew me, and they knew I'd cover them sooner or later, so they were okay with that. I also spent a lot of money where I cashed them, so they didn't mind that either. I even had the bar downtown, Jimmy Higgs, used to let me run a tab, and they had a couple of owners there, a couple of the people here know who I'm talking about. He's dead now, the one fellow, but he was a good Jewish business operator, and he would let me run my tab, and when I got up to $1,200 or $1,300, he'd take me across the street and he'd co-sign a note for me. And somehow I was always able to pay that note when it came due, or within about a month of when it came due, and we'd go through the cycle again. I started avoiding clients. I started getting sued by creditors. Doctors, hospitals, lots of people. And I kind of ignored those things. They didn't bother me. I was a lawyer, I could handle it. And they started getting judgments against me. I was in business myself, so they couldn't bother me. I could avoid their garnishments and their levies. Started spending less time at home. And what the reasoning that I used was we'd stay in motels, you know, stay downtown and drink and close the piano bars and have a good time, and decided we'd better not drive home. We'd stay in a motel. And that got more and more frequent. And it was good thinking. I ended up in the hospital one night because of that, because my responsibility conflicted with my, for the kids, conflicted with my responsibility about driving. And we're in, I think, in the athletic club downtown in a room there, and I decided I better go home and check up on the kids. And I was up in a ditch out on Highway 55 in Plymouth with my mouth busted open and hauled off to the hospital. But things like that, just crazy, crazy behavior. I don't think I was treating the family very good. By that point in time, still spending a lot of time with the kids, but most of it I was probably under the influence. The last 4 or 5 years that I drank every day, and I drank all day. I kept starting earlier and earlier, never drank before noon somewhere. I think the earliest I felt I could go to the bar was at 10:45 in the morning, and I'd usually go in through the back door and talk to the cook and the waitresses that were setting up and get started. Stay in there till 1:30, 2 o'clock, go up to the office, check the messages, let them sit and go back down, drink some more. And the business started to drop off too because of that, I imagine. A number of, I guess our family life was not good either. We used to fight a lot. I don't think that I was physical, or I was never purposely physical, although I know that at times I was, partly just because of my temper out of control and my size. So things were not good at home. There were things going on that I didn't even know then with some of the kids. We found out later after I stopped drinking. Finally moved the office out of downtown towards home. We moved out to Hopkins, where I've been for about 9 years now. The move was kind of interesting. A couple of friends of ours and my wife and I rented a truck and got down to the office on a Friday night, whenever it was, about 8 o'clock or so. Went next door to the bar, drank for a while, went up to the office and loaded the truck full of everything we had in the office, chairs and couches and refrigerator, which was full of beer. Everything we had into the truck, we drove it the 50 or 100 feet up to the bar, in front of the bar, and ran out of gas. Actually. So we went into the bar, it was about 11 o'clock, and one of the waitresses had a tank of gas in her car, a can of gas. So we waited till the place closed and used her gas and put it in the truck, and off we went. They locked me in the back of the truck in the box, which was fine because there was a light in there and there was beer on the couch, and so I was doing fine. Somewhere along the road, the truck stopped. And pretty soon the back door opened, and there they were. They'd run out of gas again. So I sent them off to look for gas. While I was sitting in the back of this truck on the couch drinking beer, we had the Hopkins police, the Minnetonka police, and the State Highway Patrol came by, wondering what I was doing. And I told them I was drinking beer in the back of the truck. And they all left. They didn't bother us. Sometime shortly after that move, I discovered something that some of you may have experienced, and somebody was following me. I wasn't sure who it was, but I knew that somebody was following me from time to time. Actually, somebody was, the IRS was, and they caught me one day and they took my van away. Put one of their tags on it, and so they couldn't have it anymore because I owed them taxes. About 4 or 5 days later, they came back and they wanted me to take the van back. Which I did. And it was a wreck. It was in the... It was in the body shop. That's where they found it, and I owed more than it was worth, and so I agreed to take it back from them, and they left me alone for another 4 or 5 years. I never had blackouts that I can recall. Except in... On October 17th of 1979, a lot of things happened to me on the 17th of the month. And I was stopped for a DWI. I was charged with DWI. I'd been stopped 15 or 20 times in the years before that when I was over .10, and I passed all the tests, and they never did anything. This time I was going the wrong way on Highway 18, and I realized it at some point and was turning around. They stopped me because I was driving too slow. So they got me into the station and asked where I was, and I could see the patch on his arm. It was New Hope. And what time was it? And the clock was on the wall. I could read that. But I wasn't going to take the test, but then I thought, hell, I'm okay. I'll take it. So I had a 2-3. And I wanted to go. I said, I want to go now. I'll call a cab. Well, they couldn't do that. They had to hold me for 4 hours. And I didn't like that because I was a lawyer, a fairly important person. And I had to be in court the next morning. So I asked them, how do I get out? And they I said, well, I can get a judge to order us the way out. So they said, give me the phone. And I called one judge, and his wife answered the phone. And that reminded me of home, because she fell asleep before she could hand it to him. And I wake my wife up every morning, and she falls asleep before she can hang the phone up. So I called another one, and he got the phone, and he was not happy. I don't know what he told them, but they called me sir and called me a cab, and I got home. And he hadn't let me forget that yet. And that was October 17th of 1979. That case wasn't ended until, I think, June of 1980. In the meantime, in the spring of 80, at the Twins' home opener, somehow or the other, I got my leg broken. More than likely hit by a car long after the game. In fact, long after I'd been home and discovered I left my briefcase down at Jimmy Hague's and had to go back down and get it. And that was a time where I don't remember what happened for about 2 or 3 or 4 hours there. That was also the closest I came ever to being put in detox. And they were all set to take me there until I saw that my right foot was just kind of hanging on there. And both bones had been broken, and I tried to walk on it. And so they took me to the hospital instead. And that also led to the only time that I ever quit drinking before I quit drinking. And I think the doctor, in fact, while I was in the hospital, had me checked out, the usual things they check, the liver and all this sort of thing, because he thought he spotted some things that indicated I might have a problem. And he didn't say so in person, but on the records he called me a chronic alcoholic, which I didn't like at all. I also found out that on that evening, the blood test they ran came up with a 0.39 blood alcohol. So I had really come to the point where other people were noticing, and a lot of people were noticing. Around that period of time, I had other people, lawyers and a couple of judges, made comments, not directly to me, but that got back to me that they thought I had been in court drunk. And that offended me because I never drank before I had to go into court. And of course, I didn't know until I quit drinking that that order and whatever carries on. And if you're drinking at 1 o'clock in the morning, if you're riding up the elevator in the courthouse at 9 the next morning, you're going to stink. And apparently I did that for quite a number of years. That was the... Anyway, after I came out of the hospital with that leg, I didn't drink for 6 weeks. And I don't really remember much about it, except we didn't drink. And I was in a cast and a lot of pain and this and that, so nothing else in particular I can remember about that, except that one of the guys that we officed with, after about 6 weeks, had made a big sale of some kind. He sold engineering stuff, sold some to the Swedish government, and it was a huge commission, and he had champagne in the office, and that was a good reason to drink again. So that was the end of my not drinking. Along about, I think it was in October of that year, there was another incident I just want to mention, because it shows how goofed up my thinking was getting, I think. And it was after something I was at, some event or some function or some seminar or something. It had to be 3-4 o'clock in the morning. I'm over in North Minneapolis in some apartment house over there, banging on somebody's door. And I don't know if that was a client. I'm not sure what I was doing there. anything like that. And two squad cars pull up. They were called by some of the tenants. Asked me what I'm doing there. And I gave them some excuse of some kind or the other. But in order to show them what a good guy I am, I pull out my billfold and start showing them pictures of the kids, you know. And what a sweetheart I am. So they ask me how I'm going to go home, and I tell them, you know, I'll call a cab, go up to 10th Avenue and use the payphone there. And both squad cars left. I got in my car and drove away. I don't know why they didn't watch for me, why they didn't stop me, but, you know, that's the kind of thinking that I was going through. I guess my activities doing business in the bars and writing the bad checks and that sort of thing had gotten me in trouble, minor trouble, with the Board of Professional Responsibility a couple of times. One time a bar in Hastings wrote to them because I had bounced a check at this bar. And they wrote back to the bar, said they weren't a collection agency, but and that's all I did with them. They did a little more with me. They wanted to know what I was doing and with my life and this kind of thing. Nothing ever came of that. There was another incident where some lady complained about something I had done, and I think mainly because she couldn't get a hold of me because I wasn't returning her phone calls. And this is a woman that I met in the bar and did a couple of things for. And whenever I had to see her, we would meet in the bar. She wrote to him and complained about the way I handled something. She wrote back the next day and told them she didn't mean it, but with those guys, you can't take it back. So they started an investigation and ran through it, and I think I had I was admonished or something with the letter. Anyway, in October of 1980, I got a letter about another complaint. And this was about a complaint about using a client's money. It was a client who had a small personal injury case, which is mainly what I do, and he was in South America or somewhere. He traveled around the country and the world on different kind of volunteer projects like the Peace Corps, that sort of thing. And he had disappeared, and at one point in time, the house was going to be foreclosed on, and I had settled his case, and so I endorsed his name, and I used the money to make up the house payments. This was about 2 years before I got this letter. He had come back to town, and he had done some checking up, apparently. And he wanted to know, or they wanted to know how his case was coming along. They didn't tell me that they knew anything, of course. And so I got a hold of him right away and told him how I was going to take care of it, and called him back in a couple of days and said we settled it for $2,500 and can we meet and I'll pay him. And absolute crazy thinking. I mean, I don't know how I'm going to give him an insurance company check. Because I've already cashed it, and I can't get another one. So I got a cashier's check or a money order or something and gave him some nutsy story about why they did it this way. You know, it wasn't their normal practice, but so on and so forth. And, of course, I'm building this case against myself as we go along. And this is, you know, disbarment type material. It's not, I can still remember just as if it were today when I opened that letter and I saw his name and knew what they were talking about. And I can't describe that feeling. How it felt. It's like everything's gone out of me, like it's over, the world is at it's just done, you know. And and I knew that was it. I knew that I would be out of practice and disbarred, or at the very best, suspended for a long period of time, because that's exactly what happens in those kind of cases. It always has. In any event, that thing went on and on, and finally they issued a complaint against me, and but between that October and the following March, I was able to handle all those problems by drinking, because I just kept on drinking. You know, the initial shock of that wore off, and was right back at it. In March of that year, I took a trip to Las Vegas, March of 1981, and went out there for a week at just a great place in Caesar's Palace in the Fantasy Tower. Everything was first class, really the nicest place we've ever been to out there, and we get out there once in a while. We were married out there, as a matter of fact. But there was something wrong with that trip. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't feel good. It was not fun. I had no fun out there. I just had kind of a dull, kind of a dead, aching feeling the whole trip out there. And that's kind of how I was feeling more and more and more every day like that, because my drinking was just at a point where it was really continuous. If I didn't know it was physically impossible, I would bet that I probably didn't get below a .10 for 2 years. But it was just that bad. We got back on, I think, a Friday evening, and we partied throughout the weekend. And Monday morning, Kelly, who, I don't know how old she is at that time, I think 7 probably, is trying to wake me up, telling me that some people are in the living room and wanted to talk to me and to Mom. And I don't know what she's talking about. I mean, except that it's too early for me to get up, and I don't want to listen to her. Finally, I get up and go out into the living room, and there's 18 people out there, and they want to talk. And they did, and we listened. I did anyway. I was happy they were there. I was grateful. My wife was angry. I never was a hunter, and probably is a good thing, because I never had any guns around the house, but if I had any that morning, I sure would have been tempted to use one. I didn't want them there. I don't know why they were interfering in my life. They didn't know anything about me. There were relatives and friends and business acquaintances, and they'd planned this thing. I mean, while we were out in Las Vegas, they planned this. And they did a pretty good job, because I think that was Monday morning, and they even had a couple of beds lined up in a treatment facility for us to go to. We did everything together. I couldn't go on that Monday because I had business to take care of. But I told them I would go the next day, Tuesday, which was St. Patrick's Day. And they finally said okay. And I think they were giving odds as to whether or not I would show up. I think I even had to go to St. Paul on St. Patrick's Day for something or other. But I said I would, and I did. And about 3:30 or 4 in the afternoon, I showed up, and we went over to Golden Valley. I think that was good for me. I think I needed that treatment. I don't think everybody does, but for me at least, I think I had to be pulled out of circulation and locked up long enough so that I could realize that I didn't have to have a drink to stay alive. And so we spent, I spent 24 days there going through the program, and they ran an AA-oriented program there. And got to my first AA meeting. Two or three of them, I think, while I was still in treatment there. And we went through the first 5. They let me out then after 24 days so that I could go home and get the kids ready for their mother to come back home. She had to stay longer than I did. If she was up here, she would say that I had to go to outpatient treatment then for 4 more weeks. But I tell her that I did that so I could help them. And started an AA after that, and have been going to AA meetings ever since, at least 1 a week, sometimes 2 or 3. I go to meetings usually every week that are just, they're limited to lawyers. Those are interesting meetings. I also go to meetings where there are real people. Anyway, in treatment, I guess I learned that I had a problem dealing with life and how I reacted to it and that sort of thing. And drinking just helped keep that going. I also liked to drink. I liked beer. I liked whiskey and vodka and gin and brandy and wine and whatever else there is except for scotch. I hated scotch. And if that was the only kind of booze that was ever made, I probably would have acquired a taste for it. Anyway, when I got out of treatment, my business was pretty well shot. Not much of it left at all. My case was still pending. I had 25 to 30 judgments against me. I had some federal tax liens. Found out that some of the members of my family were having problems that I was not aware of, some of them pretty serious, one of them with drugs and alcohol and school and that sort of thing. And started working from there. The case that I mentioned before, where a petition was filed against me and it was to have me disbarred. 2 days or 3 days after I got out of treatment, I had an initial hearing involving that, and that was before a panel of lawyers and private citizens. And they heard some limited evidence and testimony and sent me out of the room for a while, called me back in and said that I could continue to practice if I had a supervisor to watch my financial records, and if I went to AA regularly and didn't drink, or I could be suspended until the proceedings were over. So obviously, I wanted to continue practicing. Following that, they went through the regular lawsuit procedures of discovery and this and that. I turned over all my books to them, some months later, there was a hearing before a referee that was appointed. He's a district court judge from southern Minnesota. And we had a couple of days of hearings, and I had a number of people that I had known before and after came and testified for me and basically said who I was and who I was before and what they saw when I drank. The judge wrote an opinion of about 12 or 13 pages, recommended that I should not be suspended or disbarred, but should continue under supervised probation for 2 or 3 years. The board appealed that case because they wanted me disbarred, and then went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court rendered this opinion, which adopted the referee's findings completely, and also set forth some guidelines on how the courts would deal with attorneys who have drug and alcohol problems in the future. so that I never... missed a day of practice because of that, because of what I had done. And I could have been disbarred, I could have been charged with a criminal charge, theft or forgery or both, and other things, and I never was. And I think that was in due in large part to AA, to the program of AA. Because if I had not been doing what I was doing in AA and staying sober, that simply would not have happened. Other things improved. My business got better. My business is better now than it ever was. I still never have enough money, but the business is a whole lot better. I think I'm down to 4 judgments. Out of that bunch. The Internal Revenue Service liens were paid off. I got some new ones because I couldn't pay the current because I was paying the old. But we're working with them, you know, and we argue a lot back and forth, but we're still working at it. The kids are doing okay. The one that had trouble is doing okay today. He's in a different state, and he's had lots of problems, but he's sober today and he's doing okay. Part of I think the reason that I've been able to be where I am today, well, it is AA. It's the 12 steps of AA. I never lost my faith in a higher power, and my belief in a higher power. And I think that's critical because no matter how bad things get for me, I know that the higher power is there, and I can turn to the higher power, who for me is God, and it's going to be okay. I'm able to face the problems now that I used to drink to stay away from. It doesn't necessarily mean they get any better, but I can work on them. And I couldn't work on them before, so they got worse. They don't get worse anymore. Sooner or later, we'll be rid of the ones that we had. There may be new ones, but we'll deal with those when they come. Something that I believe the AA program and sobriety gave me is I was reminded just yesterday or the day before, saw a picture that taken of Sharon and I just, I think within a few months after we quit drinking and got sober. And I didn't have hardly any gray hair. How could I forget this? 9 months and 1 week after coming out of treatment, another kid was born. Most of the time, I feel pretty good today. I still have a problem. A lot of the time, I tie my serenity into my pocketbook, and that never works. I think a lot of us do that. But when I don't do that, I feel pretty good. And if I quit trying to predict what the outcome is going to be and just work on what I can work on today, then I feel pretty good. I saw a thing here, I read this day at a time or whatever it is every day, and from 2 days ago, November 24th, I cut this out. The prayer says, I pray that today I may do the next thing, the unselfish thing, the loving thing. I pray that I may be content with doing small things as long as they are right. And that really is a key for me. I don't need the big splash anymore. All I have to do is the little thing that I can do today, and the big splash will come if it's going to come. I kind of summarized what AA has done for me in terms of what I talked about earlier. This is besides the gray hair. I'm finally in the right group. I mean, I think this is a group of winners. I'm a hero to myself, to some of the kids, you know, to some people, sometime. I'm in the record books because, of course, my case with the Supreme Court is in the books. And by the way, that case of mine has been used in throughout the country and other states for them to model similar programs after, and I think also in Canada. So it's not the way that I had hoped to get into the books or the history books or that sort of thing, but it's there. And I guess it also enabled me to get up here and talk to you and not be embarrassed about it and not be afraid of it and not feel that I was being judged, but just being accepted.